Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to the Borderlines Podcast, a podcast for the discussion of Canadian immigration law. I'm Stephen Murins. On April 6, 2018, Jaskrat Singh Sidhu, a permanent resident of Canada, was driving a truck in rural Saskatchewan. He drove through a stop sign without stopping and crashed into a bus that was carrying individuals from a Humboldt hockey team. 16 people were killed, another 13 were injured. Mr. Sidhu pled guilty to 29 counts of dangerous driving. He was sentenced to 8 years in prison. He now faces deportation proceedings. On today's episode, we are joined by Mr. Sidhu's lawyer, Michael Green. Michael is representing Mr. Sidhu in his efforts to stay in Canada and avoid deportation. Michael last appeared on Borderlines podcast episode 17, where he discussed issues with pre-clearance legislation. Now, in today's episode, we do not discuss Mr. Sidhu's case specifically or in great detail. Rather, we discuss issues with the deportation of permanent residents in general in Canada. We talk about how the process works, what factors the Canada Border Services Agency and, in some cases, the Immigration and Refugee Board consider, and tips and strategies for permanent residents as well as their counsel who receive an inadmissibility report for serious criminality or receive a procedural fairness letter regarding an inadmissibility report for serious criminality. Now, one thing I note that we do not discuss and will save for a future episode is an in-depth look at the history of unsuccessful charter litigation that has gone all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada against Canada's practice of deporting long-term permanent residents. This litigation has been unsuccessful for the most part, and the practice continues. And just in brief during this intro, what I mean by that is that if someone comes to Canada, even as a baby, and spend their whole life in Canada, but they don't acquire Canadian citizenship, they can be deported to their country of citizenship at the age of 50 or 60, as the Federal Court of Appeal affirmed last year. Anyway, if you would like to contact me, I can be found, my contact information can be found at larlee.com, LARLEE.com. My name is Stephen Murins. Deanna Okanachov's information can be found at mccrae.com, MCCREA.com. And Michael Green can be found at sherrittgreen.com, SHERITTGREENE.com. I hope you enjoy today's episode.
I've spoken at a lot of conferences with criminal lawyers, put on by criminal lawyers or for criminal lawyers, and for immigration lawyers too, about the intersection of criminal law and immigration law. It's what's really important is that anyone who's a permanent resident who's facing criminal charges should not only get legal advice and representation from a criminal defense lawyer, they should also be seeing an immigration lawyer. And I want to be really emphatic that it should not be an immigration consultant. It needs to be a lawyer, because these are technical legal issues that are involved. And often this is going to play itself out in federal court or in a very legalistic process. And I've seen way too many cases messed up by people who really didn't have enough depth of knowledge, legal knowledge, to be able to advise.
When you say a permanent resident, does that include like only recent immigrants or people who became permanent residents as children, but for whatever reason never became citizens?
There was supposed to be a distinction, and it's almost all disappeared. But you know, how long you've been in Canada is a relevant factor. But the fact is, if you're a citizen, you can't be deported for criminality. Full stop. You have a right to stay in Canada, and that right can't be taken away. If you're a permanent resident, however, the Supreme Court has said in a case called Chiarelli that there is no absolute right to stay in Canada, or there's no right to enter or to stay in Canada. The government can limit those rights. And one of the things they can do is they can deport people who have committed criminal offenses or who have criminality issues. And that was more recently upheld in a case called Medovarsky after the Immigration Refugee Protection Act came into force. And they cited Chiarelli and said, you know, you are subject to possible removal. The threshold for removal, if somebody's not a permanent resident, like let's say they're a temporary resident, is very low. It's just, you know, the slightest conviction can get you hunted from Canada. But with permanent residents, it's higher. So, and this is why this goes back to the, you know, why working with criminal lawyers is so important. So if I could just maybe outline the grounds for being deported, if it's a conviction in Canada, you can lose your permanent resident status if you're convicted of an offense that would carry a possible sentence of 10 years or more imprisonment, or if you receive a sentence of 6 months imprisonment, even if it's a less serious offense, if you're sentenced to 6 months. So quite often we work with criminal lawyers advising them about what kind of a plea bargain is acceptable and what's not, what the consequences would be of different possible outcomes of a conviction or of certain kinds of sentences. Because I've seen many, many cases where a criminal defense lawyer advised a client to take a plea bargain because they thought it was a really good deal, a heck of a deal from a criminal law point of view, not realizing that it's catastrophic, it's fatal to a person's chances of staying in Canada in some cases. And I've had so many clients who said, I would never have taken that deal, or I wouldn't have pled guilty if I'd known that this could result.
Now, I want to pause on that for just a second and give like an example and then a question. So I did an appeal once for someone whose criminal counsel had pled him down from an assault conviction to a criminal harassment conviction on the basis, I guess, that in criminal law, criminal harassment is considered a lesser offense than assault. But in the immigration context, it's the complete opposite, because one falls on assault is what is known as general criminality. It doesn't have that 10-year threshold that you mentioned, while criminal harassment does. So the question that I want to ask is, you said that if it's convicted in Canada of an offense punishable by a maximum term of imprisonment of at least 10 years, or for an offense for which a term of imprisonment of more than 6 months is imposed. And I just want to highlight on that "or" to ask, so does it mean that immigration law, in determining whether someone is inadmissible for serious criminality, does not matter in that first part of whether the offense is punishable by a maximum term of imprisonment of at least 10 years, what the person's actual sentence was, or whether they're prosecuted similarly or by indictment? Does, in the immigration law context, does the law just focus on, I guess you could say, the general offense rather than what actually happened to the person in the criminal justice system?
Yeah, so it's... you know, there's different repercussions for different different things, but it's the category of offense that can be the killer on this one. And so you can be deportable, for instance, if you're convicted of impaired driving now, because the new impaired driving laws that they put in a couple of years ago increased the sentence from maximum 5 years to maximum 10 years. Well, the fact that it's maximum 10 years imprisonment, which has never been granted, nobody's ever imposed a sentence even close to that, especially when nobody's been killed. But by changing that categorization, that they put this into the most serious categorization for immigration purposes. So you could be a situation where you're stopped, you get convicted of impaired driving. Nobody got hurt. It was just technically over 08, or it was a finding that you were impaired at the time you were driving. You can be deported for that now. If the conviction happened in Canada, you're going to have a right of appeal to the Immigration Appeal Division, and they can consider all the circumstances of your case, and you may get to stay. If you got a sentence of 6 months or more imprisonment, you don't have a right of appeal. Then the only review is by an immigration officer. But what happens is there's also situations where you can lose your permanent resident status because of a conviction that happened outside of Canada. And so, and this categorization is what it's all about. So if it's a maximum 10-year sentence in Canada, if the equivalent offense is a maximum 10-year sentence, then you could be deported just on the basis of the fact that you pled guilty or you were convicted in another jurisdiction. Uh-huh. You don't, if it's serious criminality, that means it's a potential sentence of 10 years or more, you don't have a right of appeal. So if you were, let's say, on a trip to Hawaii for your Christmas vacation and you happen to pick up an impaired driving charge, that could result in your deportation from Canada with no right of appeal if you're convicted. One of the more, I think it's odious. This was a change that taking away that appeal right happened in a change that was more recent. It was in 2013 and something called the Faster Removal of Foreign Criminals Act that came under the Harper government. Before that, people did have a right of appeal for foreign convictions, but that got taken away. The Trudeau Liberals have done nothing to address it. It's really something that makes me quite sad and somewhat angry, is that there's a real lack of procedural fairness and justice happening.
When you say a right of appeal, why would someone want an appeal? Like, would the appeal just look at whether they were convicted, or does an appeal look at other factors? Like, why would someone want an appeal?
Sure. So at an appeal, the Immigration Appeal Division has a broader jurisdiction. They don't just look at whether there's been a conviction. They look at what's called all the circumstances of the case. And it comes out of a case that's quite old and called Ribic, R-I-B-I-C, which is oft-cited and totally accepted by the Immigration Appeal Division as defining the factors they're supposed to look at. So the factors they look at: the seriousness of the offense, the possibility of rehabilitation, the hardship that a person could suffer if they are removed from Canada, the length of time they've been here and the degree of their establishment, the family that they have here, and what dislocation or hardship they would suffer if the person was removed from Canada. The best interest of the child has now become a big factor in that because of the way the act is worded. And then the support that's available to the individual. Those are all the Ribic factors. Those are all the factors that the appeal division considers. And so in a hearing like that, you normally have testimony from the individual, from somebody in his family. You might have psychological reports, all kinds of evidence to show that, you know, the person is established and that they have a strong support system, that explaining the nature of the offense and whether or not the person is a threat or a risk to reoffend. Those are all kinds of things you put in evidence to show at a hearing.
If perhaps if they've been here all their life, if they have children here, all of these sorts of things, if they perhaps have no ties to their country of citizenship, all these kinds of materials.
I've got one going right now that he came as a refugee from Ethiopia when he was an infant. He has no recollection of living there. And of course, as often happens, these kids get, you know, into some criminal activity. That's what's happened, you know, to him. And he got involved in really within about a two week span, he got, you know, three offenses, with two of which resulted in or charges, three of them, and two resulted in convictions. But, you know, that's the kind of thing I'd want to go in front of the board and explain all of these things. And that this guy's a product of Canadian society.
For sure.
You know, he's not it's not a foreign criminal. Like, this is, you know, the idea that foreign criminals were invading Canada, that was used as the justification. I don't think we should be deporting people who came here as children, but we are.
Yeah.
And they're hell bent on deporting this fellow.
Yeah,
for sure. And when you say that too, like, Michael, sometimes when this person that you're defending has Canadian children themselves, and those children would then be left without their Canadian or their permanent resident parent because of the way that the efficiencies of the system, where their parent might not even have a right of appeal, and those considerations would not be taken into consideration by the board because of the lack of an appeal. These are the sorts of miscarriages of justice that I think we're trying to address in this conversation.
So, you know, maybe it's so because of those thresholds, and I've had this come up too with people who are facing charges in foreign jurisdictions, where I've worked with their criminal defense counsel in foreign jurisdictions as well. Often is, you know, what I'll do is I'll write a written opinion, sometimes an affidavit, that will be used in court, usually in sentencing, or sometimes in sentence appeals. So I've, you know, the Supreme Court of Canada has said that if the immigration consequences are a relevant factor for judges to consider, and that it can be an error of law if a judge doesn't consider relevant immigration consequences, you know, such as deportation, for instance, when they're doing sentencing. So that's often a ground of appeal. If you're trying to get the sentence changed because the sentence that was imposed is going to result in deportation.
Yeah. Michael, so are you... I didn't mean to interrupt you. I'm just wondering if you're at liberty to tell us, like, now that you've set out the framework for how this works in the immigration scheme, I'm wondering if you're at liberty to tell us how this sort of machinery worked in application to the Sidhu case, how this played out in terms of the criminal process and the criminal sentencing, and you know, how the consequences played out on the circumstances of his case.
Sure. Let's talk about what the process is. So, you know, when the Minister of Immigration got before Parliament, the Parliamentary Committee, when they had proposed the IRPA, and it was being vetted by the committee, she made representations, and her Assistant Deputy Minister made representations to the committee about how the system would work. And I remember I was, at that time, I was national chair of the Bar Association's immigration section. And so I had a lot of meetings with these people, personal meeting with the minister, where she said, my office can make better decisions than the IAD. And there had been a very high profile case in Toronto where called the Just Desserts case, where a person got shot in a restaurant during a robbery. And one of the four people who ended up being charged was a person who had been before the Immigration Appeal Division, and they had stayed his removal. There was absolute outrage that this guy was still in Canada. Now, his conviction that he was, they stayed the removal for was break and enter. So it was like, you know, it's not like this guy had a history of a really serious violent crime, but the public was outraged, and the board member who made the decision was pilloried in the press. Her picture was all over the place, And the minister, I think, was really motivated because of that particular case, and maybe others like it, to say, no, we're going to do this administratively. So she said, we're going to have a consideration of all the circumstances of the case, that is the Ribbage factors, but it's not going to be done by a judge. It's going to be done by an immigration officer.
And when she said that her officers could do it better, did you mention, well, maybe I'm getting the timeline wrong, did you mention that, but you're giving the power to CBSA, which is being created right now. They're no longer immigration officers.
Well, so that's the thing, is that when she said that, there was no such thing as the CBSA. CBSA didn't come into existence till 3 or 4 years later. What it was the immigration department, was immigration officers who routinely deal with issues of family reunification and humanitarian factors. They're applying those kind of factors all the time, that kind of discretion. And so, you know, she made these representations that these circumstances would all be considered. And moreover, that for long-term permanent residents who came as minors and had been here for 10 years, they would be considered at a very high level. So it wouldn't just be a frontline officer, it would be a high level officer, and presumably in her office. And she said, you know, her ADM, her assistant deputy minister, told Parliament that, you know, we're only under their current practice, which was they could deport people if they were declared a danger to the public. She said there were 5 or 6 of those a year. And she said, we expect that will be the practice in the future. Well, that's not what happened. And we knew this would play out like this in one way or the other. That what's happened is that the CBSA got created, the power to make these decisions went from the Immigration Department to the CBSA. The CBSA is an enforcement organization. They're basically the immigration police. And so now, instead of immigration officers who are used to considering humanitarian factors to decide in the case, we've got enforcement officers, and their mandate is to remove people as quickly as possible. And they also delegated down the long-term permanent resident consideration down to the local level. And so there is no longer any special consideration for long-term permanent residents. It's now become just one of the many factors they're supposed to consider, which is how long has a person been in Canada? Anyway, so what's happened is that it's public knowledge that Mr. Sidhu did not contest his charges. He did not plea bargain. He pled guilty to every single thing he was charged with. He perhaps could have plea bargained, probably could have, there's some question about whether his standard of the conduct of his driving would even meet the dangerous driving test set down by the Supreme Court of Canada. But he took that off the table by just entering guilty pleas, not wanting to cause any more harm, any more stress to the victims and their families. And he did not make submissions as to what the sentence should be. His lawyer put some case law before the judge, but that was it. And no more. It was just left like that. So it became an automatic thing that once he was convicted and sentenced to more than 6 months in jail, he would not have a right of appeal. And when consideration was given to whether to deport him, it would be made at the officer level.
By operation of law.
The law such as it is right now, unfortunately. So the way that process works is an officer reviews it, decides whether or not to write a report. In that report, they decide whether or not to make a recommendation to proceed to a deportation hearing or not. That report is then reviewed by a more senior officer. Formerly, that would have been at a much higher level, but it's been delegated down to the local level again. So it's a supervisor mm-hmm. who makes the decision as to whether it should be referred to a hearing. If it's referred to a hearing, then deportation is automatic because the mm-hmm. member has no discretion about what to do with the case.
They cannot. They cannot not issue the removal order. Like, I know I'm stating the obvious, but like their hands are tied. They have no alternative but to issue the removal order. Yeah.
Those cases can, you know, properly run those cases shouldn't take more than 20 minutes.
Yeah, I don't even bother accompanying my clients to them. It's not worthwhile. If I do, it's just to have somebody to hold their hand, you know, like, but there's nothing I can say or do at all.
No, you're right. We go in there, as soon as they establish they're not citizens, they'll have an affidavit from an officer that says that, that they've done a search, they're not a citizen, and then they've got a certificate of conviction, and a story.
Yeah.
And if you show the sentence was more than 6 months, then bang, no right of appeal after that. If there's less than 6 months, then they get to file a notice of appeal, and then the appeal process goes. So with Mr. Sidhu, we are at stage one of this process. He got served with a notice that they were considering, going to consider this whether to issue a removal order because he was liable to possibly get one. And we made our submissions a few months ago, actually, and we're waiting for them to make their decision.
So here's my million-dollar question, Michael, because, like, you know, what you're talking about is his window of opportunity to not get referred to the board is that he replies to this 44 report and says, don't write me up, don't send it to the board. I've done that a lot of times in my career. You know, now I don't even know how many years I've been practicing, almost 20 now. And I think I've succeeded once in getting them not to write it up. And the one time that they didn't write it up was a very, very minor misrepresentation. And the woman was pregnant and da, da, da. But like in any criminality case, I have never been successful. And I don't know if I'm just doing it wrong, but like I have found that in my experience, what officers have said is that their discretion to not write it up and not send it to the board is, and I've read the jurisprudence on this. They've said that their discretion, some officers have said that they don't even have discretion to not write it up. And I've read those cases. So I'm interested in what your view is about how much power does an officer have to not write it up and not send it to the board?
That's interesting. And I think it's got a lot to do with the culture that has developed in the CBSA over the years since it was founded.
It didn't used to be like that. I mean, I should say the one that I was successful, and I think maybe there were a few more that are just like older than my memory, but they were old. And now I just feel like it's almost like, nope, sorry, we have to do this. This is just my job. I'm just writing it up and sending it over.
Yeah, isn't that the truth? It's really the culture has changed. It's become much more enforcement oriented, and there is far less exercise of that discretion. And, you know, to my disappointment, I've had cases where the officer actually recommended that they not take this person to inquiry, and they were overridden by their supervisor.
Yes, I agree. Yes. That's exactly what I've seen too. And even I've had cases that got referred to the board, and then I was able to settle it with a counsel that was appointed, you know, to represent the department. But that referral just seems to me almost administrative, you know?
Well, it's just, you know, it's unfortunate and they developed, you know, and the federal court has been very conservative in its approach to this, to these cases. And you know, essentially, in notwithstanding what the minister and her representative said to Parliament, and basically, that, you know, that there would be full consideration of all of the factors.
All the RIBIC factors. That's what I think.
It's the proof is in the pudding now, and we can see that it's not five or six people per year. You know, it's happening just, on a daily basis, it's happening and across the country. And I'm sure there are probably some officers and some offices that maybe are a little bit more flexible or willing to give somebody a second chance. But it's quite unfortunate that the way we've seen it develop.
I find the role of the supervisor, like I've also, not in this context, but in other removal contexts, had the, I really want to do this and I want to give you what you're asking for, but I just ran it by my supervisor and they said no, so I have to say no, which adds a whole weird fettering of discretion angle to everything. But how have you ever actually when you've been confronted with that from an officer, gotten in front of a supervisor or actually learned what the interaction between the officer and the supervisor who you or the client, the person being deported, never meets or never presents evidence to directly, what that interaction between the officer and the supervisor is?
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Well, here's the thing, is that, and this is another frustrating thing, and I think it's going to change because of the Vavilov decision of the Supreme Court of Canada. But here's what happens with the process. The officer writes up a very detailed report explaining their rationale and how they dealt with your arguments and you know, why they reached their recommendation. And it's very, very thorough. The supervisor scrawls out a couple of lines on the report saying, I concur, and then because of person's escalating criminality or pattern of criminal activity or something like that, and then signs it. And you've got two or three lines. And that, I've seen that over and over again. And there's, you know, if you do an access to information request to try to find notes, there aren't any. Now, I got a feeling that somebody can successfully challenge that if they continue that practice, because the Vavilov decision says that they have to show their reasoning. They have to justify their decision. You can no longer guess at what process they went through. They have to justify it. I think we may see some challenges, hopefully successful challenges to the process they have. But, you know, this is a good time to comment on another real serious problem they have there, is the procedural fairness aspect. It's not just the mentality or the culture within the CBSA, which has become far less friendly and far more just focused on removal. It's the process they go through, which shows that, you know, a lack of commitment, I think, to procedural fairness. When they send out the letter to tell the person that they're facing possible deportation and they've got a chance to make some submissions to them, they say, you've got 15 days. Now, in some jurisdictions, they'll give them a complex form that's part of the immigration officer's manuals. And so that at least allows them to know what the factors are and give them more information. But a lot of these guys are in prison when they get the letter, and they don't have easy access to counsel, if at all. It'll take too long. And if they have to go through legal aid, there's no way they're going to get that in 15 days and be able to respond. And so they'll scroll whatever, you know, information they can to answer the questions. And usually it's in just a few pieces of paper, if that. And that becomes their entire submission. Hmm. And a decision gets made on that.
I've never seen the complex form, Michael. I've only ever seen the bare 44 report.
Yeah, so it's an appendix to the manual. I can't remember which manual is it. EMF 14, maybe?
Yeah, probably.
But it's one of the appendices to it. But I've never seen it given to one of my clients. I did see it in somebody else's paper. They appended it and said, you know, this is what our clients did send. But I don't know why they don't send that. That would be more helpful. I don't know why they only get 15. Is everything else in immigration pretty well? You get more than 15 days. So the first thing we always do is we ask for more time. And I always ask for 90 days. Mm-hmm. Ask for 90 days. But the guy who's in prison and without access to counsel, we see these cases all the time. They often, the decision's made before they ever get a chance to give any legal advice. And so they, you know, the 15 days, they either don't send anything in or they send in something that's really poor. We had a case a couple of years ago where the guy was originally from Vietnam. Although he had been here a long time, he didn't speak English. And they sent the letter. They didn't use an interpreter to explain it to him. A fellow inmate explained it to him rather poorly. And his submissions were absolutely crap. There was nothing there. He didn't know what he was doing. And usually in those situations where I've gone back to them and said, look, this person didn't get a fair shot. Would you consider reopening this so that we can make proper submissions? They usually tell me, no, he already has had his chance. And they did say that at this one, except when we moved to challenge it. And I think we went to federal court on it, but they ended up backing down. Whether they went to federal court or threatened to go to federal court, because he said, complete denial of natural justice. You did not provide an interpreter. This guy didn't know what he was. That's not procedural fairness. And so they backed down and reopened that one. But usually it's frustrating, they don't. The other thing that's really bothersome about their how they deal with procedural fairness is their failure to disclose relevant information. What they give these people is just the bare bones. You've been convicted of an offense, you're a permanent resident, you could be deported. And then that's it. But quite often they are considering other evidence that they don't show to the individual. Like police reports are the most notorious things that they do. A police report is an officer's notes at the time of laying charges and preparing charges to go to court. They're subjective. They're based on the opinion of the officer. They don't often reflect the real evidence. They reflect what evidence the officer might have had. Like, so they may have gotten a complaint. And so that complaint goes in the police report. And it may turn out that what the outcome of the case, the charges are not proceeded with, or they're serious charges are dropped. But often there's facts in there that are quite damaging. Mm-hmm. And they won't provide, because they say the police provide that to us on condition that it not be disclosed. And that's what they hide behind. So they say we're not allowed to disclose it. But then you see references and they clearly, it has influenced them, references, which is wrong. And I think that's a breach of procedural fairness.
For sure.
I haven't seen a case that's directly on point where the federal court has held one way or the other on police reports. Although there's a lot where they comment on the duty of disclosure doesn't necessarily require disclosure of every single document if the person knows what they have to meet. But we've got one that's in federal court right now where they referred to a bunch of evidence that was seized that didn't result in any convictions, including a firearm, for instance, that was found in the premises. Now, there's a premises that this fellow didn't own, but he had access to. He had a key. But there was it wasn't clear whether the firearm was something that he had any knowledge of or control of. But it gets referred to. And we did not get disclosed the police report. Moreover, their policy is they won't do any meaningful disclosure until after they refer the matter to a hearing. Well, that's too late for you to respond, because the hearing isn't going to consider those factors anymore, that you can't. And so, but that's their policy on disclosure. And it's atrocious. It's
a very interesting point, because we, in a previous podcast, talked about the Federal Court of Appeal decision in Brown, where the Federal Court of Appeal said that in Immigration Refugee Board proceedings, the CBSA has to disclose all evidence, not just evidence that's helpful to them. But in what we're talking about today, the CBSA, the stage one, as you call it, occurs before it goes to the IRB. So Brown doesn't actually address, Brown's limited to the IRB. Mm-hmm. So this lack of disclosure, as you're talking about, I guess continues to be a live issue.
Go ahead, please, Michael.
No, I'm really hopeful that it will get addressed by the Supreme Court. If you look at the parallel of what's happened in criminal law, cases are routinely thrown out because of the failure of the Crown to disclose relevant evidence, including exculpatory evidence. But that routinely, and the Supreme Court has come down very hard on it, and so that the Crown knows if they don't disclose everything, their case could fold. And you know, the CBSA, on the other hand, has been given, I think, a bit too much of a free hand by the federal courts. And remember, the federal court is not a criminal court. While it's a superior court, they don't deal with criminal law normally. They do in the military context, but not. So you got your judges at the federal court mostly don't have experience in criminal law. And that may have colored why in the immigration law, there seems to be far less procedural fairness. And also this going back to the Chiarelli decision, that you know, permanent residents are not citizens, and so they don't have the same rights. I hope the courts will revisit that in the future. And there's been a lot of suggestion that with law that's developed since Chiarelli, it's about time they reviewed that.
Well, so our firm was involved with, in 2019, there were two cases. Ours was Revelle, and the other case, I think, was called Mondano. And they both involved charter challenges on the deportation of long-term permanent residents. And the Federal Court of Appeal dismissed both challenges, and leave to the Supreme Court was denied in both cases. So at least on the charter grounds, the charter arguments, the Supreme Court, I agree, it would be great if they did revisit the deportation of long-term permanent residents especially, but it doesn't look like the Supreme Court is there yet.
I've seen the Federal Court of Appeal decision in Revelle, and that didn't consider the procedural fairness aspect. It considered whether it was a violation of Section 7 to deport somebody without a hearing, without an appeal hearing, and basically said that the Parliament can do that. That they can streamline deportation processes, but there's not been anything definitive on the exact process of how they're doing it, or that I've seen on procedural fairness.
I agree, and what you're speaking to, Michael, is this issue around the 44 report process. To me, first of all, there seems to me there's contradictory jurisprudence about how much discretion there is on an officer. And I don't feel like it's being resolved. And I don't know if either of you disagrees as to whether or not, I feel like the court is a little bit equivocated on how much authority there is to be like, you know, yes, I can say, and whether or not it's a fettering of discretion for an officer to say, you know, let me finish that thought. Whether it's a fettering of a discretion for an officer to say, I think that this is for the board to decide, or whether or not they need to substantively dive in and say, I think, and I don't know if that's actually the issue. I'm not sure whether or not that's the issue. Have you found cases where they just simply say, this is too much, this needs to be determined by the board, or what's the issue there exactly?
Okay, well, so let's just go back a little bit to the scope of discretion. And there's conflicting federal law on the scope of discretion that an officer has. And originally, there was a case called Chaw, which said they had virtually no discretion.
Exactly. That's what I recall.
Hernandez came along. And Hernandez, Justice Snyder, said there is a duty to consider the circumstances of the case. And she cited the various factors. She said for a foreign national that is not a permanent resident, that the scope of discretion is pretty limited, and they don't have to give much consideration.
Right.
But for a permanent resident, a higher threshold. But there's still been cases where, judges have saying that it's minimal, or, you know, they've minimal discretion, which is, I find.
So this is what I don't understand.
Enraging. I just think that's wrong.
I agree. And then to me, it's the question of like, well, how do you reconcile that with Vavilov? How do you reconcile that with the duties of procedural fairness, particularly when there isn't a full disclosure? This is kind of where I feel like there's still undecided, that there's unresolved law in terms of like, what do you mean by a minimal duty, a minimal discretion? How does that play out in the context of a process that's procedurally fair?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So I think there is room. I'm not, unfortunately, overly optimistic. In my experience, and I've been doing this for immigration law for well over 30 years, my experience has been the federal court is a very cautious court, and the federal court of appeal is even more cautious. And you don't get a lot of groundbreaking individual rights cases coming out of there. It has to usually go to the Supreme Court to getting anything that might be more, I wouldn't say more reasonable, but I guess more favors the individual.
More nuanced, yeah. I have to say, when I read the article in the news about Mr. Sidhu's case, this has to me always been an area of tension. We've seen this coming like a 1,000-ton truck. I hate this is a terrible metaphor, but a train coming since we started seeing the loss of it, the attrition of appeal rights, and the way that this discretion has been delegated down to the officer level. But I think Mr. Sidhu's case really very clearly epitomizes how this can go very badly wrong, and just to see in this set of circumstances how there has been a very clear accepting of responsibility, you know, exactly what the Ribic test kind of sets up. Great, very strong establishment in Canada, very clear acceptance of responsibility for what happened. All of these kinds of factors that the Ribic test was intended to take into consideration, and yet no opportunity to raise that in a meaningfully substantive kind of a hearing process. And so it seems to me that if there was going to be a case where the way that the system doesn't allow for this type of case to be brought forward, it just struck me when I read the article that this is exactly it.
Well, you know, I would think if we had a right of appeal to go to the Immigration Appeal Division, this would be a really strong case, and we'd have a really good chance of success. I just done enough cases before at that level to know that my odds would be much better than 50-50 at the board. But in the context of how it's decided now by the enforcement people, it's a much tougher case to make. And it is, I don't know what's going on. I know that the officer that's assigned to the case has a good reputation for being a fair person. And he's given us lots of time to make submissions. We got multiple extensions of time because in order to do it. So they really have, in this case, partly because it's so high profile, I think, he bent over backwards this time. But, you know, in the whole contemplation of it and the exercise of their discretion, it'll be interesting. I think he'll get more consideration in terms of they'll go through a more detailed process because of the public scrutiny that's going to be on. But there's that, you know, that factor of the social pressure too. You know, they're going to be worried about, you know, if they say you can stay, there's a potential for a public backlash. People who will scream.
One of the things that we haven't touched on yet in terms of the options at appeal is, and you just mentioned, you know, you think your odds would be higher than 50% at the appeal, is unlike with this stage one CBSA no appeal right scenario, one of the powers the Immigration Appeal Division has is to issue, so they could either grant the appeal, dismiss it, or stay removal with conditions. So say like, in Mr. Sidhu's case, you know, if there's no criminal offense in the next 3 years, then your appeal is successful, and they can impose kind of a test period on people to say,
it
sounds like a conditional discharge almost. Like, you know, if you don't commit any further offenses, if you keep the peace for 2 years, then your appeal is successful and you can remain a permanent resident, which the CBSA at this stage one doesn't have.
Well, that's a really good point, Stephen.
Totally.
This is when they designed the act. I think it's a major flaw of the act that it's all or nothing for the CBSA. They either send the person to a hearing where they'll be deported, or they issue what's called a stern warning letter, which is virtually meaningless. It just says, hey, if you do it again, you might get deported. It has no legal effect. Whereas with a stay issued by the board, if you get a conviction for a removable offense, that is one that's serious criminality, your stay automatically ends and you can get deported. You don't even have to get a hearing. They don't have that kind of discretion with CBSA. So officers have to, you know, say all or nothing. You mentioned earlier, I think, Dan, about cases where there is an appeal right, where officers tend to defer to the board. They just say, oh, if it's complicated, I'll let the board decide. I'm not going to make, you know, I'm just going to refer. And they default to referring it to the board. And I think that, you know, if I were the minister and the prime minister, I would scrap this automatic loss of status or loss of appeal rates. Or at the very least, I'd go back to the two-year threshold. That is only for people who had a two-year sentence. But then I would want to institute a meaningful process of review. And my inclination would be to have that review happen on the immigration side, not on the CBSA side. And there's precedent for that because immigration officers routinely write Section 44-1 reports where they found somebody in violation. They can do it.
Yeah.
I think it would be a much fairer consideration if it was made on that side. I don't know if it's ever been formally proposed, but I'm proposing it now. And then the other thing I said, if you're going to leave it with officers, give them the tools, give them something in between so that they can impose conditions.
Yeah. I like that. You know, it does otherwise become very daunting because it's sort of like they don't have the same range of discretionary authorities that the board does.
No, it's all or nothing.
Yeah.
What would your thoughts be on just criminal judges deciding at the time of sentence immigration consequences as well?
I don't like it. So when I appeared before the Parliamentary Committee on Bill C-43, which was where they proposed a number of things, including reducing the threshold from 2 years to 6 months, and where they also did automatic loss of appeal rights for convictions outside of Canada, permanent residents convicted outside of Canada. There was a lawyer who appeared at the behest of the Conservative Party. He was requested to appear. And he said, well, criminal judges, you know, these people do get a hearing. They get a hearing in front of the criminal court judge. Well, it's not the same at all. The threshold of what they consider is not even close. And the Supreme Court has said, one of the things they've said is they can consider immigration factors, but they can't take it out of the range of acceptable sentences for that offense. So if a criminal court judge were to reduce a sentence below 6 months because of the threat of deportation, but the normal range of sentences, say, is 2 years plus, that's going to be overturned on appeal. So you don't really get to make your full immigration case because their hands are tied. I don't think that would be the best, although I think it's good what the Supreme Court said about it is a relevant factor because there was some case law before that said that they couldn't consider immigration consequences. So that's helped. And now we're seeing more consideration and we're seeing courts of appeal recognize that that's got to be considered in sentencing. That's a big breakthrough. We just had one of our clients was successful at court of appeal and a sentence appeal. And they put it in writing. It just, they said it's, you know, the judge erred in not considering the sentence or the immigration court. They wouldn't have done that before. So it's, you know, there's some positive developments that happened. I don't know what's left. Let's talk about this. Okay, what happens if they decide to send your client to a hearing? You've made all your submissions or they made them themselves and the matter goes to hearing. It's an automatic deportation order. We know that. Now, We will challenge the reports, the decision to write a report and the decision to send them to a hearing. We'll challenge both of those decisions in federal court,
right,
and ask that they delay the removal hearing until the outcome of that challenge.
Right.
Sometimes they will, sometimes they won't. And then if they start removal proceedings, the only thing you can do is ask for a deferral. And if they don't defer removal, you ask for a stay from federal court. And those tend to be somewhat limited. But there's one other remedy that people often don't know about. And that is that you can make an application for permanent residence on humanitarian and compassionate grounds. And my belief is that you should make that application before the person leaves Canada. Because then it's an inland application as opposed to an overseas application. The case law is that the department has to consider the application. They have to process it, even if the person has been removed from Canada. And if they decide to approve the application, then the person can be brought back to Canada.
But at what point does he cease to be a permanent resident?
When the deportation, when you have a deportation order, and if you've got a right of appeal when the appeal is dismissed, or if there's no right of appeal when the order issues. So the first person, like with Mr. Sidhu's case, if he was sent to a hearing and order deported, he was stopped being a permanent resident then. So then he would be eligible to make an application for permanent residence. You couldn't make that application beforehand, but right, it's prudent to start preparing it beforehand.
Of course.
And whereas the factors in the humanitarian application are broader than the Ribbage factors. Mm-hmm. And so they allow more scope and more emphasis, for instance, on best interests of the child, of any right, children affected, as an example. But then, at least you might have a better chance, and you're then having a case decided by an immigration officer with IRCC rather than a CBSA officer. So it's you've got a better shot at it.
One thing I wanted to say just about this culture thing, though, Michael, is that in the past I used to have more success when I was doing something like that, where I had an agency application pending. In saying to CBSA, hey, would you do me a favor? I know we've got this person removal ready. Would you give a call to CIC or to IRCC and say, could you please go ahead and make a decision on that PR application? Because if you approve it, then this person will no longer be removal ready. I used to find that there was a pretty good collaboration sometimes where, they would make a call over and say, I understand that this person's in the queue. Could you please just, find out whether or not this application is approvable? And if it's approvable, then I won't go about removing this person only so that they could come back 3 months later. And I haven't found those requests they've a little fell on deaf ears lately.
No, Deanna, that's a really good point. This is part of the cultural shift that's happened in the department. And what's happened is that, the CBSA was a merger between the Immigration Enforcement and the Customs Department. Now, in terms of volume, the customs guys were about 75-80%, and it was about 20% immigration. And what's happened is, especially in supervisory and management positions, tend to be dominated by customs legacy officers, not immigration legacy officers. And what we found is most people, it used to be that people in the immigration enforcement had also worked on the immigration side of things when it was all one department. And so there was a lot of cross-pollination happening and people, they had the similar mentalities. And the supervisor of enforcement had been the supervisor of admissions before he got that job. That kind of thing had happened. But also a lot of the enforcement officers had been immigration officers at some time in their career and had that experience. What we call immigration legacy officers are almost all gone. There's relatively few. And in senior positions, there's almost none of them. And that has contributed both to the change in the shifting culture at the CBSA, but also the lack of collaboration between them and working together. I mean, you can still get some of it, But it's not the case where these officers know each other personally anymore.
No.
And, you know, they used to have examples. They used to have a great stampede party every year here in Calgary for the, you know, the immigration office. And they'd invite everybody who's involved in the immigration field, including even inviting lawyers. And they, after the split, after the divorce, I call it, they would still, you know, come and we'd see, you know, both a mix of CBSA and IRCC officers. And then in more recent years, they stopped coming. And you just stopped seeing them. And, there, and it was just like, it was just sad to see. It was a passing of an era.
Well, I just, on this point though, I just want to say like, I appreciate that some of that is just about the old culture and the divorce and all of this sort of thing. But this doesn't have to be ancient history. I mean, the idea, it just, time and time again, seeing that like, you know, somebody is going to be subject to enforcement. You know, we have a case that we're dealing with in our office right now. They're subject to enforcement, but there's like a perfectly good spousal that's just, you know, 6 months away from being approved. So they're going to remove this guy. We're going to help, you know, and again, like, you know, we're not going to bother doing a stay application, There's no irreparable harm argument, but they're going to remove the guy and then we're going to wait. We're going to get it. He's going to comply. And then they're going to bring him back 6 months later. You know, I just, I don't understand why we're doing this, you know, like, and so I get it. And whether they know one another or not from the good old days, like just pick up the phone and say, hey, IRCC, could you just pull this one out of the batch and approve? Like, or can you just hold off removal? Like there's just a nonsensical nature to the way, and I understand it's their job. They need to enforce this person was an overstay. Get it. But like, you know, it just seems nonsensical. And one more point on this is like yesterday, I just appeared across from a very young lawyer, a new DOJ counsel. It was his first JR and he just did a wonderful job. And we just, you know, like it was just, it was very collegial. I understand he's on that side, I'm on this side, but it was like his first JR, you know, it was very collaborative the whole time. You know, we consented to one another's special requests for admitting new stuff. Like, I just don't understand why this culture, it doesn't have to be about history and how things evolved. Like, it doesn't have to be well, this so, way. So,
yeah, but remember, there also have been some changes that happened at the political level. So if you look at what happened with it, 43, that was a real game changer. One of the other things they did is change the act used to say that if a person's issued a removal order, the CBSA shall remove as soon as reasonably practical. That's what it was. And so that gave them a lot of discretion. And so it put reasonableness into it and it required them to consider reasonableness. So then you could make an argument with them like, hey, it's not reasonably practicable to you know, rip this guy out of Canada when he's got a spousal application that's likely going to be approved anyway. So, you know, why bother? Now you're hit with all the time. They changed it, like another change that Harper brought in that Trudeau has done nothing about, which is to say remove as soon as possible. And that change is huge.
The federal court was all over that change too. Like they're like arguably, you know, if they weren't, it's gotten to the point where when you read the federal court jurisprudence, if an officer does show flexibility, they're almost doing it contrary to federal court jurisprudence.
It makes it very hard to get the federal court to intervene and stay removal when you've got that specific provision in the legislation. And I don't get why this government hasn't done something to remedy the, you know, some of these flaws that are there. It's just, I just wish there was somebody there that they could push it in that direction.
But I think, has this government even done a comprehensive immigration bill or just a bill that did more than amend like two sections of the IRPA at once? Like they did Bill C-6 for citizenship. They like did their comprehensive changes there. I don't think they've done since 2015.
And that deal has it referring to six different ancient citizenship acts. So I don't know.
No, they haven't. I think it's overdue, especially in this area. It's overdue. I mean, what they've done, remember, is in the immigrant selection, it's all done by ministerial instructions now. So so the minister can just issue new instructions and change the rules of the game just like that. But when it comes to procedural fairness and due process, they have done nothing to remedy what was done. They've done it in the criminal law. You know, one of the things that the Hartford government did was brought in a lot of mandatory minimum sentences. The Liberal government has undone some of those and changed the rules on that. This procedure of deportation without a right of appeal is like a mandatory minimum. I think the parallel is there, and, you know, with what I would argue if the right case came along in federal court, is that it's really effectively like that, and it's a charter breach because of that. But you have to be careful, because we've got all these federal court cases that say, no, they can do that. They can have automatic. So I think the future lies in hopefully challenging their lack of due process. But I think I don't have so much faith in the courts to do it. I think it's going to be at the political level, and it needs somebody with, you know, some commitment to this to do it. And hopefully that'll come along.
Well, Michael, I got to say, I'm very glad that Mr. Sidhu is in your hands, in the sense that I think that there's a lot of controversy in the legal field he's sitting at the cross sections of a lot of these ambiguities in the rules. And I think where these procedural fairness issues are really, really falling down, I think, unfortunately, that's right where he's at right now. I think you've got a long road ahead of you, and hearing your analysis was very informing.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. Well, it's an interesting area. It can be really heartbreaking.
And for sure.
This would be a heartbreaking case if it went against him.
Yeah, I agree.
For a lot of people involved, not just for him, but for a lot of people. I know that we've had tremendous public support. It's amazing, just from the media coverage, how strong the public support. I expected a lot of hate mail, and it's been almost non-existent. And rather than, you know, there are people who still would favor deportation, but it's been overwhelmingly in his support. So I hope that kind of has some, you know, has some influence on it. The people, Canadians, I don't think want to be as harsh as we are with this current process. So hopefully he has a shot.
Well, really appreciate your time today. Thank you so much for your insight.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work. How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.